How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvers and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is November 25, 2014, figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. A lot of news to get into here today. And Dave, what did you think of the big return on Raw tonight of Hornswoggle?
Did Hornswoggle return?
That's the Raw Anonymous GM.
They never said that.
Yeah, they did.
They did?
That was their storyline a couple of years ago. He was revealed as
I know he was revealed as the anonymous GM years ago, but I don't think it's him this time.
I sure hope not.
Yeah, no, they never said it was Hornswoggle tonight. No, I don't. That's a really weird deal because they were going to go without a GM. Maybe that's what they meant by saying they were going without a GM is they were going to do a freaking anonymous GM. Because that's what I was told. It's like, well, there's no new person's going to be the GM, so...
This show going off the air with the return of the anonymous GM.
So
and
bad.
And then that iPhone sound just beeping to the point where John Cena started laughing and Cole started laughing and said, I don't know how to turn it off. And that's how the show went off the air. I was like, wow, what a follow-up to the return, to the debut of Sting.
Yeah, I got to say this. They gave you the impression that... when they did this, the heel GM thing and John Cena won, that the days of the heel GM are over. And if they go back to an anonymous heel GM, I mean, it's just like, you know, that's so lame. It's so lame.
Clearly the anonymous Raw GM has got to be Hunter and Stephanie, right? Vince left with them. They're going to formulate a plan. The podium is back.
Probably.
What a storyline. I mean, it may not be, but that's my first thought.
It doesn't matter as long as, you know, once it's another bogus heel GM gimmick, it's like it's you know, run its course. It's just so, but I mean, even if they were going to do it later, you can't go the next day after getting rid of the heel GM and bring in a heel GM. I mean, you know, with one show with Daniel Bryan, I mean, just, the whole thing is just stupid.
Well, let's talk about Daniel Bryan in this Raw show. 24 hours after the Authority lost the match, they opened the show with a long promo. Steph came out and she ranted about how nobody understood respect, the courage to come out here and be a leader, take responsibility. We'd have won last night if it wasn't for Sting. Talks about how only John Cena can reinstate them. She's starting to weep, talking about Thanksgiving, and Hunter cuts her off and starts yelling at the people, "You want to see my wife cry? You're all bullies." Says, "Now that we're gone, who is going to replace us? This leader has to do what's best for business, something nobody knows anything about except us. You think it's going to be John Cena, Ziggler, maybe Sting?" He cut a promo on Sting. Said that the fans had ensured the demise of the WWE because without Hunter and Steph, it may last 2, maybe 3 weeks at best. Fans are chanting boring.
So TNA may get the times. God, TNA just blew it.
They did just blow it. Jeff Jarrett's got a chance.
I guess so. I mean, if they just waited like 3 more weeks, they could have gotten USA and Monday nights. Holy.
What a war this is going to be. They've started a war with Jarrett. He's going to get Monday nights. It's going to be...
Jarrett's going to get Monday nights, but what's he going to do? All of his wrestlers are signed with Access.
So now he's going to have to
get a new stable of guys. He's going to have Jim Ross and nobody else.
So Hunter's ranting and he starts cutting a promo word for word from A Few Good Men, which turned the whole thing into comedy. Said, "Soon you will be begging for us to come back." Which was ironic because I was begging for them to leave. And finally, Daniel Bryan comes out, and he just stood in their faces and mocked them with yes chants as they left the building all the way to commercial. So when they come back, he announced that he was in charge for the evening. He called out Team Authority, Seth, Kane, Rusev, Harper, and Henry. No Big Show, by the way, plus the Stooges.
He wasn't in Team Authority.
He wasn't in Team Authority, but because he shook hands and turned on the team, he should have been punished, but... That was not brought up here.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things that didn't make sense.
Bryan says he's a fair man. He's going to prove it here tonight. He starts with Seth. He says, "You're used to handicap matches, so I'm going to give you two partners tonight to take on Cena and Ziggler." He says that the fans are going to get to choose your partners. The choices are Mark Henry and Luke Harper, Mark Henry and Kane.
No, Luke Harper and Kane.
Luke Harper and Kane.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Or
no,
Mercury and Noble. And, yeah, of course, you knew what was going to happen there. So Seth goes to the back. Next up is Kane. Brian polled the fans. He ended up stripping Kane of his position as director of operations. He is now the director of food and beverage. He's concessions Kane, and he sent Kane to go selling. Rusev was next. He signed him to defend the title in a battle royal against every single man on the roster, or he could go to the ring and recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
He didn't do that.
He didn't do either. And Daniel Bryan didn't follow up, so a poor performance by Daniel Bryan in this situation here.
He didn't. He was not. Yeah, he didn't make him stick to his guns at all.
No.
I mean, I do think that it was for the better, because I think that, you know, just going through with it would have just been, I don't know, would have been blown off too much heat. But I don't know. They don't follow up with a lot of stuff. I thought it was funny that they did acknowledge the Mark Henry Rusev stuff, because when Daniel Bryan ordered Rusev to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, Mark Henry was laughing.
So next up was Harper. He was signed to a match with Dean Ambrose. And finally, Mark Henry was scheduled for a match with The Ryback, which was starting next. And by the way, for those who are keeping track, 30 minutes of talking in this opening segment.
The Daniel Bryan stuff was so too long. I mean, it was like it felt like it never ended. I mean, the first segment was like 17
it
minutes.
Did go 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, Hunter and Stephanie, I think, were around 17 minutes, and they were just. I was just going like, God, please just go to a commercial. I mean, I was begging for a commercial when they were done. Then they come back with talking, and I mean, Daniel Bryan's such a nice guy, and everybody likes him, and. You know, for a couple of minutes there, you know, he delivers those lines and everything. I thought it was pretty good. But then he's just talking and talking. I mean, if nobody should be on television on a professional wrestling show talking for 15 straight minutes unless you're like The Rock or Jerry Lawler or, you know what I mean, somebody at that level. And Daniel Bryan, you know, it's 5 minutes is plenty. He could have said all this in 5 minutes. He's going on and on. And I'm just going, my God. I felt so bad, because it's like they're going to, like, screw you over, because nobody can stay over in that, you know, in that type of position unless you have ungodly charisma. It's just gonna, you know, it's just gonna hurt you. And by the end, it was just like they weren't reacting to him at all. Well, then again, they didn't react to hardly anything on the show.
No, yet another bad crowd. What a coincidence! All these, they just happen to be running in bad cities for so many weeks. It's crazy.
Yeah, but you know, like last night. I mean, it was a bad crowd for the first 2 hours, and then the third hour wasn't that bad of a crowd. So I think that it's, you know what I mean?
Yes. My point was, it's not the crowd.
It's not the crowd. But they are putting on bad shows, because we're getting it week in and week out. I thought this show was really bad. I mean, just all the way through, it was just, there was a few funny things, and were there any good matches? I don't think there were any good matches, were there? No.
We'll go through here. So that was the opening segment. As noted, it was very, very, very long. Then we got Henry versus the Ryback. Ryback attacked him before the bell. When they came back from commercial, Ryback had laid him out and was already setting up for the meat hook clothesline, which he then hit and he pinned him. So clearly the opening segment went longer than even they had anticipated, because this got no time.
Yeah, well, another thing on that, too, is, also I think that they realized that they screwed up with Ryback last week, so they were trying to get it back, but it wasn't that hot, even in the 54 seconds.
No, because if they knew they screwed up last week, they wouldn't have had him the first guy eliminated on the babyface team last night, because that made things even worse.
Yeah, well, that's why it didn't work so well in this one. The other one, too, is like, you know, I was kind of happy they turned Mark Henry, because, you know, he's got so much more potential as a heel. But it's like, he sure doesn't now.
Nope. Nope, nope, nope. So Hunter and Stephanie are leaving, and they run into Vince, and Steph says she's sorry, and Vince doesn't want to hear it, and he says, I'm not angry. I'm not an angry man. I'm just disappointed. You have to overcome insurmountable odds in the corporate world, which is why I gave you insurmountable odds last night, and you failed. Somehow, some way, you've got to fix this. And she tried to say she was sorry again, and he completely flipped out. He said he'd never been sorry for anything in his life, nothing he'd ever said or done. He's never been sorry. And then he says, the only thing I've ever been sorry about is I have to spend Thanksgiving with you two. Now let's go. And they left.
He wasn't sorry about firing Del Rio?
Apparently not. Nothing.
Wow.
Not a thing in his whole career he's been sorry about. Harper and Ambrose for the Intercontinental title.
What an ego.
That's
seriously.
His gimmick.
Jesus Christ. Never sorry about anything?
That's right. So Big Show was wrong, too, when he said that nobody listening to this had ever made a mistake. He forgot about Vince McMahon.
That's right.
Although Vince had made a mistake, which was...
What was his mistake?
Having to spend Thanksgiving with these two.
Well, it's the only way he gets to see his grandchildren.
Yeah, I guess so.
So?
Henry and Ambrose for the Intercontinental title had a physical match. Brawled outside, and Ambrose clobbered him with a clothesline. Ambrose made a big comeback. They were losing the crowd big time, although they did get it back there at the end. Ambrose has this new move he's been doing, a flying Randy Savage elbow onto a standing opponent. Finally, at the end, Harper was trying to leave with the belt. Dean dove onto him, and then Harper just threw Ambrose into the ref for the disqualification, and boy, did the crowd hate that.
I hated this.
It was horrible.
It's like I have really hit my limit on this crap finish thing. It's like, you know, you can do crap finishes from time to time. You know, I mean, it's part of wrestling, but it's just out of control. It's like, and if you do, it's like, if you're going to do it in a TV match, just make the match go 5 minutes. You're going 15 minutes, you know, which is too long.
That's the part that drives me crazy.
It's like, 15 minutes is too long unless you really have good wrestlers. And I mean, this match, I honestly thought that they deserved better response from the crowd because I thought this was a good match and the crowd was just not into it at all. And it was sad for both of them. I mean, you know, Luke Harper's a good big guy and Dean Ambrose is supposed to be one of the top guys. And somehow, you know, I mean, it's happened a couple times now. The people just aren't as into him as they should be for whatever reason. But, And it certainly isn't from last night because they put him over great last night. But, this finish when it was over, it was just like, God damn. I mean, you know, they just did DQ last night.
They did?
I know.
And no follow-up with, I guess actually they
well,
did.
Well, yeah, they're,
right
no, he came out right away.
He did come out right away.
Yeah.
So, well, actually, first off, they did the they do the DQ, and then Harper boots Dean, goes for a dive, but Dean grabbed a chair and hit him with the underhook DDT onto it. Crowd chanted, "We want tables," goes under the table, or goes under the ring, gets a ladder, tables, whole nine yards, place is going nuts, finally. And then, yes, Bray runs out, ambushes him, gives him his finish on the floor, throws him over the announce table, buries him under a stack of chairs. So, again, TLC match coming up at TLC.
You know, like this, they really didn't give you anything else for TLC, but this match, which we already knew anyway.
No, and apparently the idea tonight was they were supposed to hint at two matches for TLC, and we have one, which we already knew.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing that was a rewrite.
And there's a lot of those.
Well, the whole show was like that. So let's see, we got when's TLC is the 21st, right?
Do not know.
You should
know. Find out.
It's the 21st. So they do have, let's see, we got three TV shows left. And yeah, I mean, I guess they can, three TV shows by WWE standards for it's a network show. You can pull that off. That's not really that bad. It's going to, you know, I was going to say it was going to be terrible, but it's a network show, so it really doesn't matter.
Is A New Day ever going to debut?
Yeah, I think pretty soon. But I mean, at least
we
had to learn tonight that they're smart, strong, and one guy can fly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And one guy can lift a lot of weight.
Yeah, the strong guy. The strong
sure.
guy and then one guy's smart, which is the one who went to, you know, who graduated and is working on his
and the other two
doctorate.
Are stupid.
They never said that. They never insinuated that anyone was stupid, only that one of them is smart.
One was smart.
One is really smart because, you know, it's the only reason he's got a job there is because he's really smart. They need a smart wrestler, or at least someone who's got an advanced degree. I don't know if anyone else on the roster has one. Shoot, the freaking people running the company don't have one.
So Santino returned with a masked luchador who was, in fact, Larry the Cable Guy with no shirt on. He wanted to wrestle. Santino said, "You can't wrestle tonight," so Larry took his mask off and Santino said, if you want to wrestle, you have to have experience. And Larry said, I once beat up Savage in Florida, but he was talking about Fred Savage.
That was so funny. Holy crap, yeah. Was that funny. Whew.
So, finally, Gold and Stardust interrupt, not a moment too soon. And that's the end of Larry the Cable Guy until he came out later to do commentary. We had Miz and Mizdow against Gold and Stardust for the tag team titles. The story is that Miz comes out with the real belts and Mizdow comes out with the replicas. So the usual gimmick, Sandow does comedy, they won't let him tag in. And finally, Miz was forced to make a hot tag to him and he made this big babyface comeback. Cody cut him off. So the big finish is Miz is on the outside. He's selling that he got hit in the face and they have the doctor coming out there. Because apparently he's going to need plastic surgery or something because of this facial injury. So Sandow actually has Stardust in the figure four, and Stardust nearly taps, but Goldust makes the save. And then suddenly Miz, who is outside selling, gets a blind tag as Cody goes for the disaster kick, jumps into the ring, hits the skull-crushing finale, and gets the pin. Cole says that Sandow is doing all of the work while Miz is selling the injury. Lawler says that is what a good stunt double should do, all of the hard work. And all I could think was, they're actually just displaying good tag team teamwork here.
Yeah, I know. And they won.
They won.
It's just, what's the big, you know, how
like
is that bad?
Everybody's complaining about it. It's like, this was great teamwork.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. It's like, usually in these situations, you know, they have that deal where, you know, the team wins and one of the guys gets mad. And I always think that, like, every time I see, like, the idea of, you know, that where you know, like, the guy gets mad, he doesn't get the pin. I always think that that's, like, the stupidest thing in the world because in football, you have two running backs, let's just say, you know. And one of them scores a touchdown and the other one is the blocker. Or maybe he's not even in the play. He doesn't score a touchdown. And they win the game. How many times in real life does the guy who didn't score the touchdown then start moping around, you know, because the other guy scored the touchdown? And when it's on your team and you've won the game. I mean, isn't that what this is?
That's exactly what I was thinking when I saw this.
I mean, it is normal pro wrestling,
it's not normal pro wrestling unless you've got two teammates who hate each other, which seems to be what they're on a kick for doing these days.
Well, could we do it with one team? Okay, because
instead
like
of a man and a bunny as well.
It's like if you're doing it with that's the thing. If you're doing that angle with these guys, okay. We have no need for Adam Rose and the Bunny. I mean, maybe like in 9 months we could do it, but it's like, you know, I don't know. I just hate the two, you know, the same gimmick twice on the same show. And didn't they do the same finish? Not this week. Not here. But
you mean
like,
last night? Yeah.
Yeah.
Kane was working the concession stand, and a woman came up and bossed him around, assigned him to chip duty. We had Rusev and Lana in the ring. She was crying that this was not fair. What kind of country forces its will upon its people, she said.
Yeah, I know. You know, on the Kane thing, though, the woman, she said that if you drop any of these chips, it's coming out of your paycheck. I thought that was quite...
Lucky for Kane, he's getting an extra paycheck. I didn't know that was part of the deal.
Yeah, that's right. Between that and his downside guarantee, he's not doing badly.
No, not at all. So back to Rusev, he said he would not be brainwashed by dumb Americans, he was just going to leave, and Brian showed up on the big screen and reiterated, you either have to say the Pledge of Allegiance or you have to face the entire roster in a battle royal. And he sent out Sergeant Slaughter to oversee this, and Slaughter commanded the U.S. flag be dropped, made them recite the national anthem, or he tried to.
Pledge of Allegiance.
Lana was starting to do it, but Rusev finally just cut her off and wouldn't let her. Sent her out of the ring, and he demanded a fight with Sarge. Jack Swagger made the save again and laid him out, put him in the ankle lock, and Rusev escaped. Where is Daniel Bryan to send out the entire roster for the Battle Royal? I don't know. Another stip. Dead.
Yeah. I don't know. Sarge has lost like 100 pounds.
He looked very light.
Yeah.
And then we had the best segment on the whole show, believe it or not. Kane was at the concession stand, and he was giving away food. And
he wasn't giving away. People had to pay for it.
No, he was just giving it away. They would come to the front of the line. He was giving them food, and they would go off with it.
He's a pretty bad businessman.
He's terrible. So Santino and Larry the Cable Guy show up.
Well, that woman should have showed up and freaking docked him. Then he does deserve to be docked.
He may be docked. But Santino and Larry the Cable Guy show up, and Kane pours the mustard all over Santino because Santino wanted mustard in his hot dog. And in the funniest moment, Kane, with a perfectly straight face, takes a hot dog, hands it to Larry the Cable Guy, and cheerfully says, "I'm a big fan." But Larry the Cable Guy.
I know. That was great.
I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, this was the best thing on the whole show, which doesn't say much for the show, but
no, it does.
But I mean, it's like when this thing was over, it's like they've done like 100 segments of comedy this year, and like 99 of them haven't been funny, and this one actually was.
This was so great. Kane was awesome here. So it was worth it in the end. We had the new and improved Fandango against Justin Gabriel. That's how he's announced, by the way, the new improved Fandango.
He's improved.
No, he's exactly the same, except they got rid of the one thing that people cared about, which was his music. He now has flamenco music, and Rose is out there. She doesn't know how to dance, so she just kind of moves a little bit.
Come on, she's a better dancer than she's a wrestler.
She's a better everything than she is a wrestler.
Okay, well then good, they've improved.
I'd trust her to do LASIK on my eyes before I'd have a match with her.
Yeah.
So they have a quick match
I heard she's really nice.
I'm sure she's a wonderful. I didn't say anything about that.
I was hearing about about how nice she was and how she was talking to my brother-in-law. We were watching this segment and he's going like, Did you know that Rosa never wins on television? And I go, she told you that, didn't she? He goes, yes, she did.
Well, at least she's aware.
And I said something like, you know, at least they've given her something to do. And he goes, yeah, she's really happy because they've given her nothing to do for the last year. This guy watches no wrestling, knows nothing. It's like, I guess, you know, as Rosa was talking to him about all kinds of work stuff. It's hilarious.
How about that?
Yeah, it was just hilarious.
Well, Fandango won, so she got to dance again. She got to dance twice on one show.
Yeah, how come they were chanting CM Punk during this match?
What the hell else were they going to chant?
Well, couldn't they wait for AJ's match?
Well, they chanted it in her match, too.
Yeah, maybe they were afraid that those rumors were true that she was gone, and so this was going to be their only chance to chant it.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Big Show came down. There was a stat on our board that stated that he has now turned 30 times in his career.
I thought it was like 32, but it's who knows?
32 times in his career. That's got to be a record.
Got to be. I don't know how many times Lex Luger turned, but...
It wasn't 32 times.
No, it wasn't. And you know what was funny is about the sixth time Lex Luger turned, it was pretty much like acknowledged that he pretty much ruined his career, or the bookers had ruined his career by turning him so many times that nobody gave a shit about him. So imagine how much nobody cares about Big Show at this stage.
Well, no one cared about this promo, which made him very angry. The story is not that he turned on John Cena because John Cena is a dick, which is a fact and storyline. But he turned.
By the way, just so we're clear on this, now that this whole thing is dead and buried and it's over and done with, there was never an explanation on why John Cena didn't save anyone, nor did anyone complain,
no.
nor did it go anywhere.
Nope. So Big Show's explanation was he was on a team that looked like he was on its way to losing, and if the team lost, he was going to be fired. And so in a fit of rage, he punched out John Cena, and he abandoned the team so that he could save himself and his family and everything else.
I didn't think that was in a fit of rage. I thought that was very calculated, you know, quick thinking on his part.
Well, he said that he...
Except it didn't work out that way.
He said he made a mistake. He said he just snapped.
Yeah.
He said if he could do it all over again, he wouldn't have done it. He yelled at the fans. They chanted, "You sold out," so he got very, very angry. And he said he was not a traitor, and if there was anyone in the back that thought he was a traitor and wanted to tell him so to his face... they could come out right now. Now, if ever there was a cue for John Cena or Dolph Ziggler to come out and face the Big Show for his traitorous act.
Well, John Cena's the one who got knocked out.
That's true.
So I mean, you know, this was obviously the spot for John Cena to come out.
And where were these two? They were nowhere to be seen.
Well, they were freaking doing strategy for their handicap match. I get that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they had to do a lot of strategy to face the Stooges, J&J Security. Seth Rollins.
Was that a knock on Jeff Jarrett too? Like everything else, and it's going down. By the way, did you see the Spud thing?
I did.
Oh my God, was that so bad?
They got it out for the guy. He's public enemy number one right now. They got to find somebody to feud with because they're not feuding with WWE.
They're going to be feuding with Ring of Honor and New Japan.
They're
going to
be feuding with Bigfoot shows. Is what they're going to be feuding with on that Destination America.
Yeah.
So Eric Rowan comes out. And Big Show called him an upside-down Sheamus, which is, in fact, true, actually. I never thought of that before, but...
What? Wait a minute. Sheamus wears a goat mask or a sheep mask on his feet?
No. Eric Rowan has a long red beard, and if you turn his head upside down, he looks like Sheamus with the red hair sticking straight up.
Sheamus' eyes are on the bottom of his mouth? Or where his mouth's supposed to be?
If you hit him hard enough.
Okay.
Maybe Conor McGregor got a hold of him. So, regardless... Eric Rowan says he doesn't like bullies. He attacks the Big Show. Big Show runs away. This actually got light Eric Rowan chants.
Yeah, but light chants are almost worse than no chants.
Well, hey, he got a reaction, which is more than I could say
Barely.
For half of the people on this show.
It really wasn't much of... I was disappointed in the reaction. I thought
Really? I didn't expect any better.
Yeah, I mean, he came... But when he came out, it's like, okay, he's the guy standing up. Nobody cared at all. You know, perhaps his turn wasn't done well.
Perhaps his turn wasn't done well, and perhaps it would have got over better if Big Show had not reminded us that he had stolen a kitty stuffed animal 2 weeks ago.
That didn't help. Well, also, that turn that I said didn't go well, there was no turn. He just showed up as a babyface one day.
That's true.
There was no nothing. I mean, you had some video where Bray Wyatt set him free. He didn't tell him, okay, now that you're free, you're a babyface, or... I'm going to bully you so badly so you're going to want to beg to leave so you can be a babyface. It's like, you're free, go.
Not to mention, why would he be pissed off because he was eliminated long before Big Show even turned? He should be mad at Luke Harper, not the Big Show.
Seth Rollins, because that's the one who got him from the blind side.
That's true. So we had Seth backstage with the J&J security. Dolph came up and said he did not believe... He said that Seth did not believe in Noble and Mercury, but he did. And so he said he'd asked his 1.4 million Twitter followers to vote for them.
You missed the best part when Jamie Noble said that we're like the Shield with Mercury. He said, we're the Shield 2.0. I thought that was tremendous.
Well, you know, everybody has to have a goal. Yeah. And by the way, Dolph's Twitter followers did not come out in mass because they only got 311,000?
310,000.
Well, they said more than 310,000, so that'd be 311,000. But regardless, that ain't 1.4 million.
Well, a lot of them are like spam bots.
Over a million of his followers didn't care. Man, what a stat.
I think a lot more than that.
Probably.
I don't think any of his followers actually cared.
We had Brie versus AJ. I'm not sure. I guess the Bellas are heels, but they came out and were kind of babyface-y.
But they they're absolutely heels.
All right. So, by the way, to answer your question, no, Brie did not go back to the old music. She has her usual music here in the ring.
God damn, that was bad.
AJ came out and cut a promo, and she said, "Les be honest," as in lesbians, and people actually pop for that.
Only a few.
She said,
only,
"You proved."
Only a few.
You're a bigger skank than your sister, so.
They pop more for that one.
Long story short, Nikki snapped AJ's arm over the top rope. Brie used that to apply a La Magistral cradle and pinned her. Nikki had actually forgotten the spot, so there was a moment of weirdness there, but AJ got to do her CM Punk pipe bomb promo afterwards saying, "Talent is not sexually transmitted," and the Bellas had to look angry. Fighting words there.
I guess.
Adam Rose and the Bunny against Natalya and Tyson Kidd. Santino and Larry the Cable Guy did commentary. Bunny ran wild on Tyson early. Tyson jumping kick to the face. Natalya tagged in but felt bad for the Bunny's face. And so Tyson got distracted. Bunny laid him out, made the hot tag. Finish saw the bunny try to grab Tyson's foot, but Tyson did a reversal. The bunny tripped Adam Rose. Tyson rolled him up for the pin. This Adam Rose-bunny relationship is deeply flawed.
It's bad television, too.
Renee was with Ryback. He was hungry, and he was looking for the concession stand, so he found it.
She got all new hair extensions.
I didn't notice.
How do you miss that?
I wasn't looking at her hair.
I'm not, like, specifically looking at her hair, but, I mean, it's, like, on the screen.
I didn't see it.
Okay. She got new hair extensions. She looks completely different. The minute I saw her, it's like, oh, there's something completely different about her head. And it's like, what is it? Why, her hair is 3 inches longer than it was last week. Now, did it grow 3 inches, or did she get new hair extensions?
Maybe she just straightened her hair.
Okay.
I don't know.
She has straight hair usually.
We spend more time talking about Renee's hair than half the segments on this show.
Well, her hair is better looking than almost every segment on the show, whether it's real or fake hair. I don't even care.
Well, can't argue with that. So, Ryback shows up, and he wants a protein shake from Kane, which, I don't know if you've ever been to a building, but you can't get a protein shake at the concession stand.
I wonder if you can at Levi Stadium.
Possible, but doubtful. Kane says they're all out, which I guess indicates they had them. And so they got into a food fight, and Ryback ran him off and then grabbed a bag and told Kane he had forgotten his nuts.
That was funny.
Yeah. This sucked. Renee with Dolph and Cena. This was a very interesting segment. Cena was ranting about how Big Show was a traitor, which begs the question, where the hell were you when Show issued an open challenge earlier? So Dolph is starting to talk about all he went through last night and the miracle of Sting, and he's in the middle of talking about this great memory when Cena rudely cuts him off, and he says it's because of Sting and Dolph that the Authority is history. He cuts a bombastic promo, totally overshadowing Dolph, and then they're done. And all I could think again was, Cena is such a dick. If I did not know I would presume he has to be turning heel, but he's not.
That's how it was scripted. They didn't trust Dolph to talk.
What an unlikable character.
Well, maybe the writers should just trust Dolph to talk, but they didn't. That's all that was.
God, it was bad. So bad.
I wasn't even bothered by any of that. I mean, there's a lot of bad on the show, and I just thought that was just an interview.
Well, I thought it was bad because you're trying to do something with Dolph. You give him a big win last night, and then you just make him look like such a geek here.
But they were going to do that. I mean, they're not going to follow up on anyone who thinks they're following up on that. Come on. You know, it's like what they're going to like have Dolph overshadow John Cena.
Well, he doesn't have to overshadow John Cena, but don't talk down on the poor guy. Like, hey, you suck. Let me show you how to do a promo, rookie.
But they don't trust his promos. That's been part of the deal all along. That's why he's where he is. You know, it's not like they don't trust his work. They clearly trust his work. They don't trust his promos.
Well, maybe they shouldn't have put him in this position.
They don't have a lot of options right now. I mean, it was him or Ryback. And after that Ryback-Cesaro match, I don't think that they were trusting Ryback to be in that position. Ryback's better off, you know, getting in a food fight with Kane. If Dolph was in that food fight, it wouldn't have been, well, probably wouldn't have been any worse. I take that back. It wasn't going to be any good either way.
So Brian came out to introduce the main event voting. 93% chose J&J Security. So they weren't even suited up. You'd think they would have gotten ready, but they didn't. They came out in suits.
They only had 2.5 hours.
That's
you know
right.
what, though? Maybe they didn't bring their gear.
Oh, come on. Jamie Noble and Joey Mercury, they know you always bring your gear.
Well, then why didn't they suit up?
I don't know. Unprofessional. They took the dress code too seriously.
I guess.
We had Seth and Jamie and Joey against Cena and Ziggler. Jamie Noble's awesome. He worked a lot of this match. And, of course, everybody I'm sure can figure out the finish. Seth ended up outside. The babyfaces hit the zigzag AA combo for the pin. And then Seth is on his way back up the ramp when Brian came down, tossed him into the ring. Ziggler hit a super kick. Cena hit him with the FU. And the show was about to end with Brian leading everyone in yes chants. When yes, the podium returned, Michael Cole announced he had just received an email from the anonymous Raw general manager. The GM has announced that next Monday is Cyber Sunday, and order and discipline will return to Monday Night Raw. Can't wait.
No.
Does that mean we get to vote all next Monday on matches and stipulations?
Yes, that's what it means.
How exciting.
Yeah.
Well, it's a hook. All right, New Japan Television. Let's talk about this. Another okay. television show with better wrestling.
So tell me about it.
You tell me. What do you know?
I probably know everything about this.
Well, why don't you tell me what you can tell me?
Yeah, it's been a deal that's been worked on for a long, long, long time that nobody knew about. It was not supposed to be announced until December the 1st when they were going to have that big press conference, but they officially released it tonight because everybody knew anyway, because they put a commercial on television on Friday. It wasn't supposed to go out. The deal was that actually the original deal was they were going to announce it on Thursday or Friday of this week, but then the decision was made that maybe it's not a good week because TNA announced their TV deal right before these guys were going to announce their TV deal, and they didn't want to do it in the same week as TNA. So they were going to move it. And then New Japan, I guess, said that let's go December 1st. So everyone agreed to December 1st. But the commercial for all the new shows on Access that started playing on Friday had been made, and somehow they never told, hey, erase the Tanahashi and Togi Makabe stuff from the commercial. So they just aired it, and then they put it on the internet. And so then people, you know, started asking questions, including me, asking many questions. So that's the deal. 13-week show starts January the 16th, 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock. So when I speculated last night about the time, I did not know the time when I speculated. But in fact, the first thing in the morning I was told is, how did you know the time? No, actually, it was like, you got the time right. So it's in a good time slot right before the fights on Friday nights. They're going to start on the 16th rather than the 9th because they're going to have live fights on the 9th, and I guess they want to promo it for a week because there's going to be no live fights for the next couple of weeks because of, you know, Christmas and New Year's and whatever. So the next live fights are January 9th, and they're going to promo it all through that night and then start the 16th. And then it's going to run 13 weeks, and it's going to be one-hour show. The matches will be from January 2013 through May 2014. It'll be the biggest and the best pay-per-view main events from that era, from that period. Tokyo Dome, G1, you know, not Power Struggle, but King of Pro Wrestling. All the big matches on the big shows. And Josh Barnett and Mauro Ranallo doing the announcing. And if it's a success, we will see more. And if it's not a success, then maybe we won't see more. But they like the idea of merging the pro wrestling with the MMA, doing the pro wrestling as the lead-in, figuring that the MMA fans may like New Japan Pro Wrestling, and the people who would watch New Japan Pro Wrestling may like their fights. So it's kind of a good thing to put them all together. And that's that. That's the deal. New Japan actually wanted to do a thing where the first 6 weeks would be the six Tanahashi Okada matches, six in a row for 6 weeks. But it didn't happen. But that was actually New Japan's idea. Was to build up that as like the world's the greatest rivalry of all time and all the matches in their entirety, but we'll probably see several of those matches. I don't know how many of them. I don't know how many of the six, but probably, you know, somewhere between two and four. I'm guessing we'll probably be getting over that 13 weeks. So yeah, a lot of good wrestling going to be there. And that's that.
And what can you tell us about the TNA deal? Anything new on that?
let me see, TNA deal. They're starting to negotiate contracts with people. I haven't heard of anyone who signed. Aside from that, you know, new look, new this, new that. All new TNA, most likely on Wednesday nights, but still not official, the time slot. Probably not, like, the same time slot they've had. And first show's January 7th, which we already, or most likely January 7th. I mean, almost for sure. And no idea of the taping right now. But they're running low on time on the original idea for December. So they better finalize it like yesterday, or else it's probably not going to happen. Because if they don't finalize it like tomorrow, you know, nothing's happening in after Wednesday. That's for sure. Because it's just, you know, no building that they're doing business with is going to be around. And you know, the idea of booking a date, which they don't have a date, selling tickets, getting tickets ready on sale, just not happening given the month we're in and everything. So I don't know what they're doing next, but yeah, we've got, they're not going to have many, you know, all those companies, Lucha Underground, New Japan, TNA, and Ring of Honor, they're all going to be, you know, probably relatively similar number of viewers, you know, maybe, yeah, relatively similar, I'm guessing. I think Ring of Honor will probably have the most, but it won't be a big gap. Not that that really matters, because the, you know, for New Japan, it really, you know, it doesn't matter at all. They've got their business. You know what I mean? They sell their tickets. They're making their money at home. So this is just added money. This, you know, they're not living and dying. TNA is living and dying on their viewership. I don't know how that's going to work. Lucha Underground is different because it's, you know, it's owned by Robert Rodriguez and Mark Burnett, and these guys have more money than, you know, they have money and they can do whatever they want with it. And they're committed to it for a while. So they're okay. But TNA, man, I don't know. I don't know how they make it. I mean, I'm sure they will for a while. I just don't know. It's how do you, when you were losing money on Spike money, which is considerably more than they're getting, you're going to have less exposure, which means less people to buy house shows, merchandise, whatever. No plans for house shows anyway, that I can tell. And, you know, less TV money. I mean, they can cut back on salaries and on talent to a degree, but they're already pretty much, you know, close to bare bones on that. I mean, not quite bare bones, but they're not that far from that. And then I don't know. You know, I mean, I guess it's always been a challenge for them to make it work. But, you know, Bob Carter hasn't been that thrilled about the money losses. And he probably should have sold when he had the chance. But
probably should have been negotiating this TV deal then.
What alternative do they have?
Well, alternative of not running a promotion for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, that's they could close down. Yeah, and wait for WWE to implode without Hunter and Steph and then get on USA in 3 weeks, yeah.
That's right, yeah. All right, we got to get into this WrestleMania 12 audio. This is a longer one, everybody, so buckle up. This is WrestleMania 12 from the Lapsed Fan Podcast, Dave and Jack Encarnacio. Here we go.
Dave, you were there in the Anaheim Pond to see Shawn Michaels versus Bret Hart go Broadway, as they used to say, 60 minutes in the Iron Man match, first time it's ever happened at WrestleMania, perhaps the last time it will ever happen at WrestleMania. What were your thoughts on this match, taking it in as it happened?
I mean, it's a funny thing because I've got my dual stories on that one because I saw it live and then I went home and watched it on TV, and it was two different feelings. In the building, the people in the lower part of the building, and I was not in the lower part of the building. I happened to get my tickets from one of the biggest stars in the company whose name won't be mentioned, and it was way up. So I was in the upper deck with people who didn't care at all, and, you know, about this match. They were just, I mean, it was the It was terrible. People were leaving early. I'm not saying the match was terrible. The reaction was terrible. When I then watched it on TV and you see the reaction of the people, and I could even tell watching it that the people on the bottom were, you know, they were liking it a lot more than the people where I was sitting. And even after the show, I remember, you know, some people came up and it was just like, you know, they were going like, ah, it was a good match. I mean, nobody was saying it was a great match. It was a good match and this and this. And I'm going like, where we were sitting, this match was boring and people were walking out, you know, and I know technically it was good. Well, then, you know, I watched it. I went home, watched it on TV, and I actually thought it was a pretty good match. I don't think, you know, when people talk about it as like the one of the greatest wrestling, you know, WrestleMania matches of all time or greatest 60-minute matches or something like that, I've never, even the TV version, I never thought it was like that. I mean, the building was, I would say, about a quarter empty by the time that match was over. And when Sean was doing his celebration, everybody was gone. The people didn't stay. I mean, it was not a great way in the building, if you were in the building, for Sean to kick off his reign. In fact, I thought it was horribly disappointing in that sense. You know, the people in the building, honest to God, the people in the building were there for Ultimate Warrior's comeback. They were not that hot for Bret and Sean. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, in time, you know, Bret and Sean became much, much bigger stars. And, you know, it's funny because Bret was always strong in the Los Angeles market, and Sean later became strong in that market as well. But, you know, whatever it was a very Ultimate Warrior crowd that night live.
Is there any truth to the rumor that neither Bret nor Sean wanted to be the first to lose a fall, and so that's why they decided to go to the sudden death overtime?
No, this was Bret's booking, and Bret had the idea that we'll cross people up by not doing a fall and then doing it the way they did it. I think Bret was a little bit, you know, the idea that he would have the sharpshooter on at the end, which actually I thought was pretty darn good, because the idea was for Sean to win the title, and Bret was going to leave, but leave that linger of doubt that Bret kind of got screwed. And when Bret came back, which they were all expecting, then you can go to Bret and Sean as the main event for the next year, which at the time was the plan, which it didn't happen. I did think live, and I even think now that I would have liked to have seen three falls each, you know, a lot of falls, and have, you know, it be the tie, Bret have the sharp, you know, I thought the Bret having the sharpshooter on, the bell ringing, him not winning, and then going into overtime and losing. I really liked that idea of it. But I would have, you know, even four falls, you know, but go in with an even number. I think anything less than four wouldn't, you know, two would have been too few even. I think four falls would have worked. Six falls would have worked. Eight falls would have been too many. So, but zero falls, I didn't think it was the right idea.
Yeah, because at that point, why not just have it be a one fall match and just go an hour? You know, why make it an Iron Man match? Why not just say here?
Well, because if it was an hour match, then at the hour, it would actually be a draw. But with the Iron Man match, part of the stipulation, the Iron Man match is it's a must be a winner match.
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
And so it must be a winner match necessitates the overtime, even though Bret walked out with the idea that he didn't know that, you know, it was kind of established. Whereas like we've seen hour matches, and when the hour is up, it's not like they go, well, there must be a winner now. Go back out there. So that was the reason.
Do you feel like part of the false finish there, Dave, so to speak, was to keep Bret strong? Do you think that?
Oh, absolutely. It was to keep Bret. Yeah. Because they were trying to build for the idea that he had a, you know, they were both babyface. So the idea was Sean won and Sean pinned him and he got his win and he got his celebration. But Bret, you know, they wanted the Bret fans to think Bret got screwed, and they wanted the debate, and they wanted it to, you know, it's hard to headline two straight WrestleManias, and they didn't do it because Vince panicked. But then, and also, well, I shouldn't, you know, they're, it's panicked, A, and more important, Sean wasn't there for the next year's WrestleMania, which is another story. Yeah. But
which we'll get to.
Yes, of course. It was definitely to build, you know, to win the title. But the idea was absolutely build a rematch, you know, because they're the two best guys.
So this was Shawn Michaels' crowning achievement in so many ways, played up as sort of the ultimate coronation in the WWF tradition of the new guy, the new face. And I'm thinking to WrestleMania 11, where he is sort of positioned as the headliner against Diesel. I think back to WrestleMania 10 when he breaks through in 94 with the ladder match. When did you, Dave, start to feel like Shawn was on the path to becoming the guy, to becoming someone who would be coronated in such a way on the biggest night of the year for the WWF?
Remember when he did the thing with Owen Hart, the angle where he was, where, you know, after the Syracuse thing, they played up that he was, his career was over and that he may have suffered horrible injuries.
Right. He was attacked in a fight and he got a concussion, and then they had Owen kick him in the head on Raw and act like that was the reason.
Right. Yeah. They played off the concussion, which they never had really publicized too much. I mean, I guess they did to a degree because he had to vacate the Intercontinental title to Dean Douglas and he missed a pay-per-view out of it. But so people knew about it, and they, you know, they tried to make that a shoot, so to speak, you know, where you really believed that he was really hurt and he was making this comeback. When Sean came back from that, I really noticed that Sean could draw, and it was hard. You know, his business wasn't good for anyone to draw. Sean, when he came back, the numbers went up. And that's when I thought, you know what, Sean, I thought Sean could be world champion. I thought Sean would probably be world champion the year before because I thought he had more than Nash. And you know, even Nash himself will say in certain ways Sean sabotaged him in the spotlight, in that match they had, even though they're best friends. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on that night, you know, you could even tell in the sense that there were certain moments, and Sean, I think, probably didn't know what he was doing, where you could feel that there was, even though Sean was the heel, I remember they turned him the next day anyway, because he got so many babyface cheers, that you could feel, you know, and Sean was so much better than Nash as a wrestler. And the big guy thing wasn't really working. So even then, I would say that I saw that he's probably going to win the championship at some point. At that WrestleMania, even before that WrestleMania, when this thing was being built up, it was very clear where it was going. But when he came back and he started to draw, that's when I was thinking, like, you know, we got a guy who can draw and he's a fantastic wrestler and he can be, you know, he can be that face of the company right now. So, yeah, so that would be when the comeback from the fake concussion thing was probably when I really saw that he could be bigger than he ever was.
Now, during the free-for-all pre-show for WrestleMania 12, the WWE showed the culmination of the Billionaire Ted Wrestling War Room skits. Could you comment on the skits leading up to the show and the quote-unquote payoff?
I just remember thinking that it sucked, but I thought they all sucked. I thought that they were all, like, really, really hypocritical and mean-spirited. You know, especially because it's, I mean, I know Vince was trying to fight and he was, you know, at this point already, you know, he's losing the fight. You know, he ended up winning it, but he was losing at this point. And I just thought, you know, so much of that stuff of like, look, these guys, you were kicking these guys' ass for whatever it was, 11 years, 12 years. And they never, you know, and then the minute, you know, you you did everything to them that they're doing to you, you know, take the talent and blah, blah, blah. And so now it's coming back and I just, you know, that and just the, you know, again, the knocking of Hogan and Savage after all the money they made him. I mean, I think that's, you know, and then, you know, again, for Vince to knock people on the steroid thing, granted, they were drug testing and they were probably you know, they dropped the drug testing. I think it was like 96, if I remember, but so it was right, you know, they were right about to drop it, but they were doing it at the time. So they were the cleanest, I would say they were the cleanest that company ever was right at that time. So they could do that, but it's also like, my God, though, you know, it's like, what did you build the company around? And now you're knocking Hogan and Savage for being so big. And it's like, that's how they made you all the money that they made you. And just Randy with Elizabeth and everything, you know, that was a real sore subject, you know, and again, like if I know that Hulk and Randy, you know, were did not like it at all. And I just felt, you know, like I appreciate I will say that there were some of the skits, the one with Elizabeth and the shoe and everything that I thought was hilarious. I did like, actually, I probably liked half the skits, but the ones where they, the ones that I felt were mean spirited, I think, rub me the wrong way. And I just remember, I don't actually specifically remember the last one at Mania because they all blend together,
they all died.
Yeah. But what I do remember is being in the building in Los Angeles when they did the last skit, and I don't remember which one it was, but I remember that it was a very embarrassing thing in the sense that I'm talking the first four or five rows. These are the WWF diehards. They got up and clapped and gave it a standing ovation, and everyone else in the building is just like looking at each other going like, oh God, this was really bad. So yeah, it didn't work in the building at all.
So this would be the year, Dave, 1996, where Scott Hall, who works as Razor Ramon, or was supposed to work as Razor Ramon on the show against Goldust in the Hollywood Backlot Brawl. Takes off, Piper fills in.
Yeah.
And Kevin Nash has his goodbye match, so to speak. Well, actually, he goes on to work Shawn the next month at the April pay-per-view, but has his last WrestleMania match here against The Undertaker of this run, and then they jump to WCW, and the NWO forms, and the WWF is challenged like never before. My question is, did you see the business changing the way it did when Hall and Nash jumped? Did they feel like big enough players in this point in 1996 in the WWF to make such an impact just by jumping to WCW?
I knew it would be an impact. I can't say I thought it would be as big as it was, but I mean, as far as being able to beat WWF, I mean, they were already dueling them equally on Monday, and they were presenting a better product. So the idea, and I would see my friends, and they would go, you know, like it was like, you know, the WWF is so old and slow. Not old so much, but God, the wrestling in WWF is so slow compared to the wrestling in WCW. I would hear it all the time. So I could feel the momentum, and that didn't have with Hall and Nash. That had to do with the different product. I mean, WCW was so ahead of the curve when it came to the in-ring wrestling, you know, because again, we had gotten, in the 90s, the United States had, I used to say, and it was the truth, you know, the U.S. was from 1984, you know, as big as Japan was, and Japan was big. But from 1984 to probably 90, 91, the U.S. was the place, you know, was where you could make the most money and all that. From 1992 until the Monday Night Wars just heated up our business, you know, we were a third world country. I mean, I would go to Mexico and wrestling was way bigger and wrestling was way better. I'd go to Japan. I mean, we weren't even in the league of those places. WWF and WCW, you know, people were like, oh, you know, like in our country, it's like they were number one and number two. It's just like AAA was New Japan and All Japan. They were, you know, even FMW, which I wouldn't, you know, necessarily, you know, as crazy as it was. I mean, these people were doing stadium shows. And we were struggling. You know, we weren't filling basketball arenas. Nobody was, and they're doing stadium shows. So we were a third world country, and part of it was they were ahead. You know, their wrestling was faster, and it was ahead of the curve, so to speak. And Vince was stuck in his own way with the big guy mentality and the big slow stuff. And the crowd wanted something different. They wanted the big bumps and everything like that. And then WCW. They brought those guys in. They made that deal with New Japan, which, you know, brought in the Ligers, and you had the Liger-Pillman thing, which was the beginning of something. And then more, you know, they brought in all the Mexicans, and you had Rey Mysterio, which took everything in a completely different direction. And it was just, you know, they had that element that WWF was behind the ball on. And I think that was a lot of it. So, but as far as Hall and Nash, I mean, they were two key guys. At an important time, I did think that they would be difference makers. But when I remember going to a house show at WCW, this was before the real turnaround, before Hogan joined the NWO, but Hall and Nash were there. And it was really interesting to see just how big at a WCW show Hall and Nash were. And it really like surprised me that they were bigger than any of the WCW stars. And that's when it was like, wow, these guys are, these guys are a real big deal.
And what lured them?
Money.
There it is. I thought, you know, so.
Money, I mean, and schedule. You know, I mean, you know, schedule is part of it. But they, I mean, Scott was making $400, and I believe he was offered $650. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was $750, but I actually have seen the numbers now. He was offered $650, but it was also $650 for maximum 180 dates, and he was probably, I don't know that he was working $300, but he was probably working, you know, over 250 as far as real numbers went, and they were never home and never seeing their family and this and that. So it was sanity and more money. And Nash, you know, was offered 750 because Nash was making more money than Hall and WCW. So it took more money. And he's also the smarter businessman anyway. And they had escalators and all that where they were going to, you know, get raises and things like that. And they ended up making a killing during the next, you know, whatever it was from up through about 2001, you know, cause they even made money. You know, they even made money the year the WCW folded for another year. So you know, money was the key thing. Schedule was part of it. Those were the two things. And Eric Bischoff had seen he went to the Tokyo Dome for the UWF, one of the UWF versus New Japan shows, and kind of saw that Invader thing and the Incredible Heat. And J.J. Dillon had gone there and seen it as well. And So they were there, you know, luckily for them, they were there to see this thing. And unlike Vince, who, you know, the mentality of I've got to keep my brand strong and I can't make these outsiders look good, Eric went in the other direction. Mm-hmm. You know, Eric was just like, you know, we're going to just give these guys everything and make our guys look like shit, which was probably too much. But in the short run, it actually was beneficial. In the long run, it probably killed the company.
You mentioned being in the building that night and knowing that most of the people were there for the return of the Ultimate Warrior. Now, it was a short-lived return after Warrior was fired from the WWF in 92 after making the WrestleMania 8 comeback that we've recapped here in The Lapsed Fan. What is the story behind Warrior's 1996 return and why it all flamed out so quickly?
Two reasons. I think that number one, it was just a different era, and it was a nostalgia thing, and it was, you know, you could see when he came back, like that first night was just huge. But it always, you know, something like that should be huge, right? I mean, look at every time Hogan came back, you know, it was really huge, but it doesn't have legs. All the nostalgia things are like that. And he was a nostalgia character by that point. So it, you know, once he was on the road for a while, you know, he was still selling merchandise and he was still popular, but he wasn't moving the needle like they expected. And then, you know, him and Vince had, you know, all kinds of problems. The big one being that he had a comic book that he wanted Vince to buy all kinds of copies and sell it at the arena. And Vince said no. So he said he was going to no-show some dates if Vince didn't do it. He no-showed those dates. Vince essentially fired him. He complained that it was – his father actually died that weekend by coincidence. So the whole thing was my father died. That's why I didn't go to the shows. And Vince thought, no, you held me up. And I said no. And then you no-showed like you said you were going to do. So you had that thing. And at that point, you know, again, he wasn't making the difference in business and he was a headache. And so Vince cut the cord.
And of course, the guy he worked that night, Warrior, that is, was Triple H, making his WrestleMania debut here at 1996. And of course, would go on to great fame and fortune and influence in the industry. Also,
that's also a great story because Triple H went to that building, you know, thinking that he was going to have a match with the Ultimate Warrior. And when he got there, Ultimate Warrior, you know, told him what the match was going to be. Mm-hmm. And he was on the ascent at the time. And the idea of going in there and being a 90-second job guy was not what he was thinking was his role. I mean, you know, he knew he was going to lose that match, and he should have at that point. It was the showcase for the Warrior. But he thought, you know, he could be the guy to carry the guy and kind of get something out of it. And Warrior had no such thing. And, you know, Warrior – and, I mean, Triple H would knock Warrior forever, even though at the end, I guess, they did in the last 6 months of Warrior's life end up becoming friends. I believe that. I know some people are skeptical of that. I mean, I know people who are close who just goes, oh, you know, he hates him. And I go, you know, I mean, maybe he does, but I, you know, I felt, you know, that they negotiated and I felt, you know, maybe he did like him at the end, but you know, they went through years of, you know, he would call him the most unprofessional guy he ever worked with.
And also a very significant debut, to say the very least, on the WrestleMania stage here in 1996 was that of Stone Cold Steve Austin, who worked Savio Vega. Of course, he came in as the ringmaster in 1995. By this point, the Stone Cold character, the bald head, the black trunks, etc., the harder nose style was starting to emerge. What did you think, Dave, of Stone Cold's sort of initial tenure in the WWF before he really broke through? What was it that finally connected and hit with him?
Okay, my thoughts when he came in as the ringmaster with a bald head with Ted DiBiase was, I was so disappointed because Steve Austin was such a good wrestler in WCW and he'd gotten a bad hand dealt to him when Hogan came in and those guys didn't know him and they wanted to bring their buddies in from the past and they just didn't know this guy. And you know, they saw him as a worker who wasn't a star. So they just wanted to get rid of him and they did, you know, I mean, you know, not necessarily get him fired. That was his doing in a lot of ways, you know, by, you know, not showing up at a TV taping and holding up another TV taping and different things that he did at the time. But, you know, I thought in WWF, you know, the guy's really good and he's main event talent. And he went in there with Ted DiBiase and it wasn't working at all. And it was just like, oh man, this guy's, you know, he's one of those guys like Barry Windham or something where you just go like, you know, in WCW, you think that this guy's going to be it. And then he goes to WWF and he's just nothing. Then when he changed, it was like, it was for the better. But I will say it at WrestleMania 96, I certainly knew it before SummerSlam of 90. Survivor Series of 96 when he wrestled Bret.
Yeah.
Certainly before that. Probably when the Pillman stuff would have been the summer. I mean, certainly by the Pillman stuff, when I saw the work he did in the Pillman stuff, I knew he was going to be a really big deal. Of course, as big as he got to be, of course not. You know, nobody knew that. I mean, I don't think I really knew how big he was going to be. My first hint of how big he was going to be was when he was in the ring with Mike Tyson and held his own verbally and physically didn't feel intimidated. And, you know, that's when I really saw he was going to be gigantic. When I saw he was going to be big babyface would have been, I mean, early in the year before the Brett match. I mean, the Brett match at the next WrestleMania put him over the top, and I knew he was going to be a top guy. But he was already, in my mind, a top guy. When he had the Brett match at SummerSlam at the Garden, I mean Survivor Series at the Garden, right? Wasn't it the Brett match? Survivor Series?
Yep. Yep.
Right. So that night, I mean, I knew this guy was going to be a top guy and a top main eventer and the top heel in the company, and all that. Main event guy, strong main event guy. With the Brett match the next year, I knew he was going to be even bigger as a babyface and a solid top babyface. But the Tyson thing was when it was like, okay, this guy's going to be, the next Hulk, I guess I don't say the next Hulk Hogan, but a Hulk Hogan level guy, where it's a big time difference maker and game changer.
So there you go. WrestleMania 12. And I was just thinking about this the other day because I was watching Nitro from around the time that Sean had the incident in Syracuse. And I love how people nowadays, it's rare now, but I know I've heard it from people who say, oh, well, you know, we didn't understand the dangers of concussions until just a few years ago. And it's like, if you remember during that time period with Shawn Michaels, the story was post-concussion syndrome. He had a head injury. He was not supposed to wrestle. We knew about this stuff long ago.
We've known about it in boxing.
In boxing.
Dating back 100 years.
Pugilistica dementia.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly I remember when I was in college in the 70s. I mean, I remember talking to Muhammad Ali's boxing coach was a teacher at San Jose State. And I remember a long discussion I had with him, and I was probably, in my teens. And he was he'd had, 150 fights, and he was in his 70s, and he was, brilliant. And, he was just fuming every time that they talked about it. But I'd watch these other boxers, and it's like, okay, it didn't affect you, and you had great head movement, so you probably didn't get hit that much, but it didn't, like, everybody's like this.
All right, let's do a few of these questions here before we wrap it up. As great as he was in the mid to late 80s, I was wondering if there was ever serious consideration to giving Barry Windham a world title run.
Well, he got one in WCW a couple years later. Never in WWE. He was never considered for WWF. The thing with when he was at his peak in WCW, it coincided with, really Ric Flair's peak. And even though Barry Windham was a better wrestler than Ric Flair at that time, not much better. I mean, they were the two best guys. I think they were the two best guys in the world at the time. But Barry certainly was more gifted as an athlete, and he was bigger and could do more things than Rick. Carrying guys, that was Rick's forte, but Barry was right there with him. But as far as being world champion, again, hanging around both of them, as Rick was the world champion. Rick was the world champion personality-wise. Rick was, it was just the difference between a guy who was going to draw you big money and Barry who was not going to be that guy. So, part of it was that he was around during the heyday that was the heyday of Ric Flair, and he just wasn't better than Ric Flair as far as being a world champion, not as far as being a wrestler. That's a different story. And as far as the drive, he didn't have the drive Ric Flair had. I mean, I just remember, guys would go like, if this guy had Ric Flair's drive, there'd be no stopping him, but he didn't. And by the time he got the title, I think that, injuries were starting to catch up to him. Because he started very, very young. I think he was probably in, he was a star by 19, so he was probably in the ring at 18, 19. So by the time he was in his 30s, he had a lot of years of a lot of hard matches. And he was a big guy, and he gained a lot of weight, too.
Kenneth here says, did either of you notice the large bump on Kane's spine at Survivor Series? Is he injured, or was it just a cyst?
I noticed it, but I don't know anything more to it. As far as than that,
a lot of people actually mentioned that yesterday.
Yeah,
All right. This person says, for a company that often likes to make things monotonous, the road agents seem to be a diverse crowd. You have guys like Arn Anderson and Dean Malenko, and on the other hand, you have a guy like Joey Mercury. What does Vince look for in his road agents?
Well, it's not really Vince hiring anymore. I mean, it's now Paul Levesque, so it's I can't tell you. You know, I mean, I think he's probably looking for smart guys. And I mean, people rave about Joey Mercury as far as being a smart guy. So I don't know him, but people really do rave about him. Arn Anderson, very solid guy. You know, Malenko, solid guy. So you know, you're looking.
Let me bring this up since you mentioned Malenko. So in Jericho's book, when he's talking about the famous story with Vince McMahon and Frank Shamrock,
yes,
when Vince McMahon is talking about his crew of guys who will take these fighters out, he mentions Dean Malenko.
Dean Malenko and Fit Finlay, right?
And for a guy who's always so fixated on size and such, the idea that one of his hand-picked tough shooters is Dean Malenko, nothing against Dean Malenko. It was just funny when that was one of his guys.
Well, people knew Dean, you know, Dean trained with Carl Gotch. So people knew that Dean, you know, was certainly better than most when it came to that. I mean, he wasn't, you know, Dean was never the level of his brother as far as being a shooter. But, you know, he had real training, you know. I mean, Dean's father was a great wrestler. And, you know, again, with Carl, you know, Carl was probably, I don't know if Carl was the best teacher, but in wrestling, everybody thought he was. So I think that there was that feeling that, you know, Dean's a shooter.
Chris says, do you think Vince Russo will be joining TNA with the move to Destination America?
I can't rule it out, but I don't think so. Just think it's a lot of bad blood. Could time heal it? Yeah, of course it could. So like I said, I don't rule it out, but I don't think it's happening now. I don't know. I think as long as Gaborik is there in that position, I think that it would be very difficult because they really, I'm not saying they didn't get along. I don't know if they got along or not, but I don't think that Gaborik wanted him there for a long time before he was gone anyway. And it was Dixie did. And once he got rid of him, I don't think that he was a guy who was so like hot to bring him back. Dixie, on the other hand, could she be? It's happened before. You know, I mean, look, that whole deal that they did with the hide and the secret and all that, that tells you that's a weird level to want somebody that bad.
This person says, do the WWE have plans to put a bold primetime Superstars of Wrestling challenge in their NWA WCW counterparts? This would put some of the old Saturday night's main event clashes and pay-per-views into context. I know they're mostly squash matches, but some big angles were started on them.
I mean, slowly. It's very expensive to get the footage ready. That's why they're not doing it all at once. It's you know, again, and they're trying to cut back anyway. So it's a slow roll. But yeah, I mean, they'll always be adding stuff. And I don't know if they're ever going to get to 100,000 hours on that network or 130,000 or whatever the crazy number they got in there.
How about they start with 5,000?
Well, they'll get there eventually.
I liked in The Observer when you were writing about how when they had a list of what was watched and what was not watched and how there weren't a lot of people watching a lot of the old pay-per-views. And it was like, no shit. If you can't watch the television leading up to the pay-per-view, why would you watch the pay-per-views out of context? I mean, if you want to go back and watch some old WrestleManias, but like a random like WWE pay-per-view in 2004 with no TV leading up to it, like why would anyone watch that? I bet it has like 5 views.
From what I'm hearing, people aren't watching the old stuff. And so they're looking at what people are watching and not watching. And they got cold on the old stuff because from day one, it wasn't what they thought
it would
be.
It's just hilarious. It's such a self-fulfilling prophecy. I stopped watching the old stuff too because it was out of order.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. I I don't know why they didn't do it.
And the only reason I'm watching Nitro is it's in order. I can actually watch all of it.
Yeah, but it's not like it's not like people are actually doing that. But the thing is that, yeah, it's very different from what I thought it would be. I thought that you would roll out one show a week from, you know, 15 different companies, put it on in different times, you know, at a regular time, and get people hooked on the week-to-week storylines. And they did not do that at all. Because, I mean, that's the way these shows were meant to be viewed. I mean, wrestling wasn't meant to be viewed like an island where, okay, you watch this show. I mean, the show is part of a series of shows. You know, it's part of a – it's like watching episodes of a soap opera, you know, just random episodes of a soap opera out of order. It's just like, why? You know, it's like it doesn't make any sense. If you're watching them in order, you know, even like an old TV show, you know, like – you know, you can watch like an old episode of an old TV show. I mean, but it's best watched.
Well, it's one thing if it's like Leave It to Beaver, where it doesn't matter what show you watch. But if you're watching an episodic television show, that's completely different.
Well, even that, when I'll just give you an example. In the old days of syndicated television, and I don't care what the show is. It can be Seinfeld or Friends or whatever, you know, Mary Tyler Moore Show or whatever, you know, All in the Family or Bill Cosby or whatever. When these shows were big in syndication after their run, the TV stations that ran them, you would run the show in order always. I mean, I would remember like you would go in there and you know, you would repeat them, but you go through the cycle from year one to year whatever in order, and then you would start back with year one. And I mean, I watched shows that were, quote, before my time, that were good shows, you know, on in syndication when the shows would be on daily. So we would get five episodes, you know, a week. So, you know, you would get the whole season. I think they did maybe, like in those days, maybe 30 episodes a year. It wasn't like 23. So in 6 weeks, I would get a season. So if I watched, if it's a, this is a show that had seven seasons, you know, I would, in less than a year of watching the show, I would get the whole run. But I enjoyed it and watched these shows because they were in order. If they would show episodes, you know, not at a regular time, and completely out of order, and I would go to episode one to episode four, then back to episode two, then to episode seven. I mean, there's no way in it. I'd just kind of given up. I'd given up by the third day of the week. I mean, that's how television is meant to be, and that's when these guys were writing their wrestling shows. They were writing them to be part of a segment of things. They weren't writing them to be especially out of order. I mean, they weren't writing them for the future. So, I mean, a lot of times when people judge stuff then based on now, it's like they're not writing this. You know, they weren't doing this stuff for 2014. They were doing this for 19, whatever. But they were also doing it in order. And, I mean, yeah, like, I don't know how long I'd have stuck on with that world-class championship wrestling, because that was the stuff, you know, they started in the 82 stuff, which was the stuff, you know, I remember. But, you know, once I saw that it wasn't, That there was a real key segment in the build up to Flair Kerry Von Erich match that I remember. It was, you know, and it never aired. You know, it's like I was watching the shows to build up that match, and then all of a sudden it's like there's the match, and it's like, wait a minute, there were all these segments that I remember that added to this match, and they haven't aired. And it was just like, okay, this is just, it was such a disappointment to me that I just like said, I don't got time for this stuff no more. And I probably would have burned out on it anyway, but it certainly would have taken a longer period of time to do that. It was just like, this, I know how this stuff is meant to be, and there's, you know, a lot of the stuff also because of rights, musical rights, and all kinds of different things, restoring the tape. A lot of the tapes are very, very expensive to put on, which is probably why they did it out of order, because it's probably that. The episodes that didn't air were probably going to be too expensive to put in, but, you know, but that's the breaks. That's what, you know, that's why I wasn't that interested.
All right, everybody, with that, we're going to wrap it up here today, but we've got a lot of stuff coming up over the next couple of days. We've got shows to do. We've got, I believe, Adam Cole on at some point this week to talk Ring of Honor and all of the usual programming as well. Wrestling Observer back issue should be up right now. If not, it'll be up tomorrow. And a brand new edition of The Observer is up. If you haven't checked out the Hall of Fame issue, you can still go up there and check that out as well as everything else in the archive. So check it out, everybody. We'll talk to you again after a while.